I'm here with Dusty Narducci, who is our in-house eating disorder expert, and we're talking about diabulimia. And why are we talking about it? Well, it's because I saw some tweets on it. I had no idea what it is, and I knew Dusty was just the person to talk to about it.
So Heidi, I must admit, when you asked me about diabulimia, I knew there was a podcast just waiting to be created. Diabulimia is defined as deliberately skipping or decreasing the use of insulin in patients with diabetes with the intent to lose or control their weight. So most medical professionals actually prefer the term ED in DMT1 or eating disorder in diabetes type 1 rather than this media coined term diabulimia. But you know how it is. The media always seems to do a great job at making things sound a bit more catchy.
This just in, water is wet, and it's delicious when it's cold. What this means for your weekend after the weather.
Yeah, when you listen to the media term diabulimia and you think it's bulimia in the context of diabetes, but I don't think it's that simple. So how about you tell us a little bit about what the DSM-5 says about it?
So the DSM-5 does not classify diabulimia as its separate diagnosis, but rather as insulin omission as a purging behavior. So it can get a little bit confusing and the definitions can be a little bit gray. Essentially, think about diabulimia as a separate diagnosis of insulin omission with the purpose of trying to lose weight. But if there is binging and restricting, it's a bulimia. If there's normal eating and restricting of insulin, it's a purging. And if they're restricting both food and insulin, it's anorexia nervosa.
Whew, okay. Whatever it is, it ain't good.
It is not good.
Now, who is more likely to be affected?
Diabulimia is certainly more common among our adolescent population. One study found girls between the ages of 12 to 19 with diabetes type 1 to be 2.5 times more likely to develop a clinical eating disorder, and sadly, 2 times more likely to have a subclinical eating disorder than those without diabetes.
Wow.
Those numbers are pretty high.
Yeah, those numbers are really high. That's surprising.
And then another study found that 2% of pre-adolescents and 11 to 15% of adolescents and 30 to 39% of adult females with diabetes controlled weight by skipping their insulin doses. I didn't even know people were doing this until I got into specializing in eating disorders.
Well, let me tell you, I am missing a lot of cases of that if those are the stats.
And as I always say, just because you haven't seen it does not mean it hasn't seen you.
So true.
So true. And 21.2% of the participants with diabetes type 1 and 50% of those with diabetes type 2 had disordered eating behaviors, with the highest percentage of those being aged 15 to 19 years old. A study followed 126 girls with diabetes type 1, and their ages were between 9 and 13. And then over a 14-year period, 32% were found to meet a criteria for eating disorders.
Wow.
Absolutely sad.
Now, are there reasons other than a desire to lose or maintain weight that patients may develop diabulimia?
As with all eating disorders, it's not as simple as just wanting to lose weight. There's often deep-rooted issues driving these behaviors. So think about a young diabetic female who's conflicted with the poor messages from the media and is initially diagnosed with diabetes type 1. So now she comes in and she's educated on banning foods, having a banned food list and a good food list and diet plans so she can treat her diabetes.
Right. So there's all this focus all of a sudden on what she's eating.
Absolutely. And as seen in all chronic diseases, patients can develop anxiety pretty easily. And this can then lead to an unhealthy obsession with food and body image. You're basically just kind of creating a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Sounds like.
So also something to consider is that the body weight is reduced as a result of insulin deficiency before the diagnosis of diabetes is made. Then we give patients insulin, which results in regaining of the lost weight. This truly is just a disaster waiting to happen in a young adolescent female with perfectionism traits trying to make it in our appearance-obsessed world.
We don't know anybody like that, do we, Dusty?
I've never met anybody like that. Nope.
Especially not in medicine. Nope.
No,
not at
please.
All.
Please. Perfectionism?
Holy. Okay.
Gina, you're wearing sweatpants. It's Monday.
So?
So that's against the rules, and you can't sit with us. You can't sit with us!
So we know that this is more common in young adult females, but are there other risk factors that we need to think about?
So exactly how you said, it's more common in our young, usually 7 to 18-year-old females. A BMI that's considered obese or overweight is actually thought to be somewhat of a risk factor. body dissatisfaction, anxiety and depression, and even a lack of family support are all included in risk factors.
So tell me what I need to know and what I need to do as a primary care provider, because again, this is a new diagnosis to me and I'm sure I've missed it.
So early diagnosis with intervention are correlated with improved outcomes in patients who have eating disorders. We know that for sure. And eating disorders in type 1 diabetic patients are likely to persist into adulthood if they're not treated. So early intervention, early diagnosis for sure. Becoming comfortable diagnosing and treating eating disorders in general is just difficult, but it's absolutely crucial. And sadly, primary care providers receive only limited training in how to treat feeding and eating disorders.
Yeah, so true. So true. So, Dusty, what questions should I be asking of my patients with type 1 diabetes to help tease this out?
A great question to start with is, are you concerned with your weight, how much you're eating, what you're eating? Also, are you trying to lose weight? Is it hard to control what you eat? Is it hard to control your weight? Do you adjust your insulin because you want to control your weight? All of those questions are crucial. Furthermore, don't assume that because someone is of quote-unquote normal weight that they are mentally and physically healthy. I see this happen way too often.
Yeah, I think we all do. Now, how about a screening tool? Some docs just love a good screening tool.
Don't we all, right? Consider using a screening tool such as the Diabetes Eating Problem Survey Revised. Got that, Heidi?
Woo! I think there's an acronym for that.
DEPS-R.
Kind of rolls right off your tongue, doesn't it?
Okay. And this screens eating disorders, which is recommended for all patients with diabetes type 1. And it should be started at every visit between the ages of 10 and 12 years old. So this screening tool was originally validated for adults, and it consisted of 28 self-reported questions and higher scores on the DEPS, it was called at that time because it wasn't revised yet, indicated more disordered eating behaviors. So once the DEPS was revised, we call it, as we already said, DEPS-R, or Diabetes Eating Problems Survey Revised. This one is now only a 16-item diabetes-specific self-reporting screening measure, and it's for adolescents particularly. So this DEPS-R is rated on a 6-point Likert scale, and a positive score is equal to or more than 20. So studies have shown excellent internal consistency and external validity, but these were all from really small sample size studies.
Now, what are some warning signs? And I'm thinking I might know one of them here because often I've noticed my young patients with type 1 diabetes miss their appointments more frequently than the older cohort.
That is a great example. Definitely look for that in your patients. Also, forgetting diabetic equipment is common. Decreasing how often they check their blood glucose levels. Discomfort taking their insulin in front of others. You'll see sometimes that they just don't want to take it. They're not comfortable anymore because they're probably not taking their insulin. And then also an increase in sleep patterns because they're just so tired. And then depression as well as anxiety or other mental health conditions.
Okay. Now, what are some warning signs I can look for? Like today, we've kind of talked about the patient who looks well, but when should I really start to be worried?
So you want to start with just your overall signs of an eating disorder. And those are going to be sudden or unexplained weight loss or weight gain, sudden changes in eating or physical activity. They're really going to develop a preoccupation with body image or food. Sometimes they'll have abdominal complaints. There might be electrolyte abnormalities that can't be explained on their lab values. And then avoiding social situations with food.
What about physical findings are like cardinal features that we really should not miss?
Yeah, so symptoms to be observant of in the early period of diabulimia really are going to include your excessive thirst, urinary frequency, recurrent hospitalizations, probably for DKA, frequent UTIs or yeast infections, irregular menstruation, blurry vision, recurrent skin infections, slow wound healing, and then sometimes even a high A1C above 9.2% that mismatches to their blood glucose level.
Okay, so a lot of them is going to be symptoms you would think of with hyperglycemia.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, because they're not taking their insulin.
Nope.
Now, let's talk about long-term effects. And I bet a lot of these are related to just having uncontrolled diabetes.
So sadly, yes, long-term consequences and irreversible findings are similar to those seen in your uncontrolled diabetic. So your neuropathy, your retinopathy, your nephropathy, vasovagal syncope, osteoporosis, chronic diarrhea, and the list probably goes on and on and on.
Is there any impact on mortality?
Yes, unfortunately, coma, stroke, and death are all possible. These patients are going to have poorer metabolic control, which is going to require more frequent hospitalizations. Patients with weight-related insulin restriction were found to be 3 times more likely to die over an 11-year study period and to die on average of 13 years younger than those who didn't restrict their insulin. How sad are those numbers?
Ouch. Wow. Let's get practical, Dusty. How do we treat, how do we manage diabulimia? How do we help our patients?
So never the answer that we want to hear, but currently there's no specific treatment for diabulimia.
Great.
All eating disorders require a multidisciplinary team to address the complex issue. Clinicians really need to encourage patients and families. Good diabetes management to be the goal, not perfect control. We have to stay away from that perfectionism in this age.
Yes. Perfect is the enemy of good.
Yes. So trying to obtain perfectionism can lead to an increase in diabetes, burnout, and increase the risk for developing an eating disorder. Symptoms of depression have seen benefit from psychoeducation and cognitive behavioral therapy, so those treatment modalities should be considered. If there's a higher level of care that's needed, clinicians really need to choose a center for eating disorders that's going to specialize particularly in diabulimia, as well as other feeding and eating disorders.
Okay, Dusty, wow, this has been very informative. Do you have any thoughts you want to share as we wrap up the segment?
Recap.
Diabulimia is not as rare as we think. And as primary care physicians, we really need to recognize it and be ready to kind of ask our patients and care for our patients and have a plan in action. So clinicians should regularly ask patients how they're feeling about their body, food, and insulin use, and really should monitor closely for any type of disordered eating behaviors. We need to be cautious and kind and make sure that we educate our medical students, our residents, our fellows about eating disorders such as diabulimia.
Perfect, Dusty. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise here. I know it's given us all the opportunity to learn more and to know what we should be keeping an eye out for.
Thank you so much, Heidi.